Wondery Plus subscribers can binge new seasons of American Scandal early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. A listener note, this series is about a shameful chapter in American history. As part of telling the story accurately, we present the point of view of doctors and others from the period who express racist and white supremacist views. Listener discretion is advised. There's one thing Peter Buxton hopes everyone at today's meeting understands. He's no bleeding heart liberal. He's been a Republican all his life, and that's not going to change. So if they think this is a matter of some naive, starry-eyed idealist from San Francisco sticking his nose in where it doesn't belong, well, they couldn't be more wrong. Buxton looks down at his watch. A ceiling fan whirs overhead. He shakes his head. The tardiness is typical of what he's been dealing with since his arrival in Atlanta for the CDC Syphilis Research Conference. The government invited him out, paid for his flights and accommodations, and then basically ignored him. The only reason anyone even agreed to this meeting is because Buxton's been making so much noise about the Tuskegee syphilis study to his bosses at the Public Health Service. They said it was an opportunity for him to make his argument in person, but Buxton thinks it's just to keep him in line. Well, they can stonewall all they want, because Buxton's prepared for a fight. He looks down at the documents he's brought with him, reports and charts, neatly organized in a plain manila envelope. All the evidence he needs that the study is a moral outrage. Finally, hearing footsteps, Buxton double-checks that his tie is straight. As the men start to file in, Buxton rises. "Hello, gentlemen." He's met with silence, frowns, outright glares. No one shakes his hand. So he sits down again. The officials cluster around the opposite end of the conference table, the end furthest from Buxton. So Buxton stands, walks down to their end of the conference table, and takes a seat. "Well, gentlemen, thank you for joining me today. I'm Peter Buxton, venereal disease investigator out of the PHS San Francisco Bureau." Dr. William Brown, head of the venereal disease section of the PHS, nods silently and folds his hands. Behind his head hangs the American flag. He's going for intimidating, but Buxton thinks Dr. Brown looks nervous. To his left is Assistant Surgeon General Dr. John Cutler. He looks irritated. Cutler rolls his eyes in Buxton's direction. "We know perfectly well who you are, Mr. Buxton, so why don't you just get on with it?" Buxton doesn't miss a beat. "Well, Dr. Cutler, I'd be happy to get on with it. The Tuskegee study is morally unjustifiable and must be ended immediately." Cutler smirks, shakes his head dismissively. "You know, I read the report you sent to Dr. Brown here. That's actually why I came today. I decided I need to meet you in person. See for myself if you're some sort of alcoholic or lunatic or something. Rambling on about a study you know nothing about. People you've never met. This is serious work we're doing here, young man. Serious work. You're lying to these men, to their families, letting them die from something that's been curable since 1945. Let me remind you, it's 1967, sir. You're talking about harm to these black sharecroppers? Are you serious? They have nowhere to go but up. God, do you hear yourself? The PHS has spent 35 years using these men as guinea pigs. More than 600 men, Dr. Cutler, and hundreds of them have already died. Mr. Buxton, everyone in this study is a volunteer. A volunteer. I suppose you think the Jews in Auschwitz were volunteers too? That's completely uncalled for. I will not be lectured to by some arrogant young report here. A report you wrote, Dr. Cutler. You wrote that the subjects would have never agreed to the study without the, quote, suasion of burial expenses. I did not write that. I didn't write that. It must have been written by one of my colleagues. Which one? I'd like to speak with him. Let me tell you a story, Buxton. About a group of poor, totally uneducated and unsophisticated men. Their government observed them, yes, but for the good of science. And meanwhile, their government also fixed every other ailment these men suffered free of charge for the duration of their lives. Lives that lasted much longer than they would have without that care. Who else in America has it so good? Okay, Dr. Cutler, now I'll tell you a story. Imagine one morning you wake up to this headline. White doctors in decades-long conspiracy to experiment on black men. The article describes you and your colleagues standing by as one by one these men succumb to blindness, heart injury, and insanity. For years, the black men said, "Doctor, what's happening to me?" And the white doctors lied. And they're still lying to this day. Are you actually threatening us? You have no idea what you're talking about. I don't see what else we have to discuss here. Buxton gathers his documents. No, I'm not threatening you, not yet. But gentlemen, you better hope the world does not find out about this. Turn on the TV. Watch the news one of these nights. Race riots, black power, Negroes are not sitting for this kind of thing anymore. If we allow this experiment to continue, we are everything they say we are, and we'll deserve everything we'll get. Buxton stands, and without another word, exits the conference room, leaving the door wide open behind him. American Scandal is sponsored by Audible. I get the thrill of, say, skydiving, but it's a lot of work and expense for something that lasts only minutes and comes with some safety concerns. Instead, I get my thrills in a lower dose, stretched out over hours with a good mystery. Like in the Penguin modern classic Perfume, The Story of a Murderer by Patrick Susskind. And as an Audible member, I can choose one title every month to keep forever from the entire catalog of classics, bestsellers, new releases, and Audible originals, ready to listen whenever, wherever on the Audible app. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500. That's audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500. American Scandal is sponsored by True Green. This is a true story. Right now, fertilizer is spilled all over my garage, and the fertilizer spreader has lost a wheel. While I'm usually pretty DIY, some things I leave to professionals. True Green is the easiest and most affordable way to a beautiful lawn. You water and mow, they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. You can trust True Green to give you the best lawn because they are the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. They offer a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. So you do you and let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people, guaranteed. From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is American Scandal. The Tuskegee study was nearly four decades old before anyone seriously questioned it. But it was never a secret. The black test subjects didn't know what was going on. But as the years passed, more and more people in the white medical community did. Journals published papers regarding the study. Doctors discussed it freely during conferences. Throughout the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, the doctors who knew of the study saw it as worthwhile research that wasn't hurting anyone. But beginning in the 1960s, others in the healthcare field, like Peter Buxton, saw something else, unmitigated racism. Buxton learned of the study in 1965. As an employee of the PHS, he attempted to end the study through the proper channels, writing letter after letter to people at the top of his organization. He wouldn't let it go, and this led directly to his confrontation with Cutler in 1967. But it wasn't until 1969 that the CDC, which now oversaw the study, finally decided to take Buxton's objections seriously. Officials convened a panel that February, not to end the study, but to discuss whether it should be ended. This is Episode 3, Controlled Genocide. Dr. David Sensor removes his glasses and rubs his eyes. He always thought being director of the CDC would be a dream job, not a nightmare. The holier-than-thou gadfly Peter Buxton quit 2 years ago, but that has not stopped this Tuskegee thing from following Sensor around. He opens his eyes and watches the doctors file into the conference room and take their seats. The state health officer of Alabama, three medical professors, and a senior officer from a medical foundation. Plus Dr. Sidney Olansky, who used to run the study in question, but now works at Emory University. And of course, Dr. Brown from the PHS. But there are no medical ethicists and no black people. Sensor doesn't need them here stirring the pot. He's gathered the best of the best, and he's sure they can figure it out on their own. Once everyone's seated, Sensor gets started. He doesn't see the point in dragging this out any further. He briefly describes the study, then tells the men they're in this room to decide its future. When it started, there was no talk of discrimination or bigotry, and no one had a problem with keeping the test subjects away from treatment. But now people are asking questions, and things are getting political. So, says Sensor, throwing up his hands, We're here to decide, do we let the study go on, or do we kill it? Before opening things up for discussion, Sensor asked Dr. Brown to review the numbers. Dr. Brown begins talking in a shaky voice. According to his data, the original study group from 1932 was comprised of 412 black males infected with syphilis and 204 black male controls who never got sick. According to recent figures, just 56 syphilitics and 32 controls now remain. 373 men in both groups are dead. But Brown tells the panel that he's certain, very certain, that syphilis was the primary cause of death in only seven of them. The youngest survivor is 59 years old. The oldest is 85. Sensor then announces that the matter is open for discussion. Who would like to speak next? Dr. J. Lawton Smith, ophthalmology professor at the University of Miami, argues the study must continue. He's examined the test subjects for signs of weakened vision and blindness and taken photos. He wants to continue doing so. 20 years from now, when these patients are gone, we can show their pictures. You will never have another study like this, he declares. Take advantage of it. Sensor is encouraged by the nods he sees, but one man isn't nodding and is clearly unhappy. Dr. Gene Stollerman, chairman of the Department of Medicine at the University of Tennessee. In a low voice, Sensor says, before we continue, could one of you shut that door? Sensor considers the many doctors seated around the conference table. Of the men here, Stollerman is the only one who wasn't aware of the study prior to being asked to assess it. And if he has reservations, well, disagreements in medicine are nothing new. Stollerman can make his arguments. Sensor is confident that he can counter them all. Dr. Stollerman, you look like you have something to say. Yes, Dr. Sensor, I do. Now, I don't want to debate anyone as to the scientific merits of the study. Now, there might even be a few. But that has nothing to do with the morality of what's happening here. The morality. Yes, Dr. Sensor. It's time to think of these test subjects not as test subjects, but as unique patients suffering from an illness. I mean, what happened to the Hippocratic Oath? You're not suggesting. Just a moment, please. I'm not finished. By the standards of our profession, this is an unethical study, at least as it's presently being carried out. I'm not going to sit here and say kill the study or else, but I will say this. Let's examine each patient, then determine on a case-by-case basis if treatment would be beneficial at this point in their lives. But that would completely undermine the goals and intentions of the experiment. And frankly, I take issue with your ethical judgments here. I don't find the study unethical. The test subjects are being treated, just not for syphilis. And I'm thankful for that, Dr. Sensor, believe me, as I am sure these men are. But penicillin exists. It didn't in 1932. It does now, in 1969. Though it may be inconvenient for some people in this room, we have a moral obligation to cure these patients if possible. Well, respectfully, I disagree. Understood, I know you disagree. But I'd like to add just one more thing. More and more people will find out about this study in the years to come. I don't want to be here when they find out that we purposefully withheld penicillin from men who could have been saved by it. There's only silence. Sensor scans the room for a rebuttal. He's thankful to see it appears Dr. Olansky may already have one. Olansky, please, go ahead. Well, thank you, Dr. Sensor. With regard to the penicillin question, surely you must know that introducing the drug this late in the progression of the disease carries its own risks. I don't know that these risks are worth it, frankly. Of course, Sensor thinks. Treatment at this point is dangerous. He's grateful when another doctor says that he assumes the group probably wouldn't even accept treatment if offered. So why even ask? Sensing momentum fully on his side, Sensor puts it to a vote. The results are nearly unanimous. The study will continue. With that settled, Sensor asks the panel to tackle a second issue. How do we make sure the press sees this our way? Everyone knows the most bulletproof way to protect themselves would be to get informed consent from every test subject. But Sensor tells the group that this isn't feasible, so what's the next best thing? He is disappointed when Stollerman speaks first. Why isn't it feasible to get consent from the men? Sensor explains it slowly, as he would to someone who's not very bright. The test subjects are mostly elderly sharecroppers who didn't make it past grammar school, if they ever attended it in the first place. To get informed consent from them, the doctors would first probably have to explain what consent even was. Then they need to break down the facts of the experiment. Those facts would certainly lie beyond the comprehension of these men. But some form of consent should be attained. So how do they do it? One of the other doctors presents Sensor with a solution. It's called surrogate informed consent. They'll go to the physicians of the Macon County Medical Society and get them to sign off on the study on behalf of the test subjects. It's a win on all fronts for everyone involved. The censor adjourns the panel and thanks the physicians for their participation. In the weeks to come, Censor spearheads efforts to secure the cooperation of the Medical Society. By September 1970, he has it. It's official. The Tuskegee study is in its fifth decade with nothing to stop it. Untreated syphilis will still be observed, the subjects still won't know about it, and each of them will be brought to autopsy in due time. The CDC will learn a lot in the process, Censor anticipates. The future looks bright. As the fog rolls in outside his apartment in San Francisco, Peter Buxton sits at his kitchen table with the afternoon's mail. He sorts through and stops when he gets the letter from Dr. Brown. At least it says it's from Dr. Brown. Buxton wouldn't be shocked if his boss, Censor, actually wrote it for him. Buxton tears open the envelope and reads. He hates moments like this, when one's complete cynicism is validated. Brown confirms that the experiment in Tuskegee has been reviewed by a group of extremely qualified doctors who have come to the conclusion that it shall continue with no treatment provided to the test subjects. Dr. Brown stresses that the decision to forego treatment is a matter of medical judgment, since the benefits of such therapy must be offset against the risks to the individual. The latter is more or less what Buxton expected, but it's incredibly frustrating. He knows Dr. Brown isn't at heart a bad person. None of these doctors are. They just cannot see this from any perspective outside of their own. He wonders what words he could use to help Dr. Brown see the true nature of what's going on here, why it's unacceptable and unethical. These black men are not just test subjects, they're human beings. And despite the enticing scientific possibilities, there are just certain things that human beings do not do to other human beings. It's really as simple as that. As he begins to type his reply, Buxton knows his words will fail to convince Brown, if he even reads them. But Buxton writes anyway. It feels good. He types and types. He chronicles the history of the study decade by decade and declares that the subjects can no longer exercise the choice of ending their days free from syphilis. He catalogs the moral, medical, and legal issues and concludes with this. What is the ethical thing to do? Compensate the survivors? Compensate the families of all the subjects? Or should the CDC await the quiet demise of the survivors and hope that will end the matter? Buxton believes that medicine is supposed to be simple. Not easy, but simple. If a person has a problem and you know how to fix it, you fix it. That feeling you get when you know you made someone better is supposed to be the reason you do what you do. Rereading his painstaking chronicle of everything he knows about the Tuskegee study, he wonders when that changed. Reply to Brown in hand, Buxton walks to the mailbox at the end of his block. He's surrounded by a murky gray gloom, as far as the eye can see. Dr. Brown never writes back, and for the next 2 years, Buxton obsesses over the experiment. He attends law school and brings it up at every opportunity. He talks to fellow students. He talks to professors. Everyone tells him the same thing. It's a terrible experiment, but there's little legal recourse. The statute of limitations has likely expired for most of the test subjects involved. Buxton could try writing the ACLU. Maybe they'll know what to do. But finally, in July 1972, he bumps into Edith Lederer of the Associated Press at a dinner party. He tells her the story. She decides that together, they'll tell the world.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The day after her conversation with Peter Buxton, Edith Lederer rushes to her desk at the Associated Press and rummages through it for a number. There's another journalist who must take it from here.
Hello, Gene Heller, AP Research Bureau.
Gene, hi, it's Edith.
Edith, hey. I'm just about to head out to Miami for the DNC, but I've got a couple of minutes.
Perfect. I won't keep you, but I really need your help.
All right, I'm listening.
I need you to investigate the PHS and the CDC. I'd do it myself, but my boss says I can't. He wants someone closer to the action, and since you're in D.C., I thought of you.
What action?
Well, you ready for this? 40 years of experimentation on black men in Alabama.
Excuse me?
Yeah, that's right. Most of the test subjects have syphilis and have had it since the 1920s, but the doctors never told them, never offered penicillin. They're intentionally letting them succumb to the complications of their disease simply so they can observe the effects. They're going to do it until every single one of them dies. There's a long pause on the other end of the line. Finally, Heller responds.
That's messed up.
Yeah. So you can help me?
Yes. Where do I start?
Well, I've got most of it together. Charts, letters, stats, everything you'll need. I'm literally just going to put it in a box and ship it to you, and I'll let you take it from there. You think that'll work?
That'll work.
After Lederer hangs up, she immediately begins packing the documents to send to her friend in D.C. Jean is the perfect person to blow this wide open. She's the best investigative reporter Lederer's ever met, and she knows everyone in Washington. Jean will go to the CDC, interview everyone she can. She'll dig and dig and won't stop until everything buried is uncovered. And by the end of the month, Heller's work is done. When she calls Lederer to let her know, she still sounds surprised at how easy the CDC made things for her. Lederer knew they would, though. After all, as they see it, they took the prudent step of securing informed consent for the test subjects. Ethically, they're not concerned, and legally, they're in the clear. But maybe they're not prepared for what happens next. The story breaks on July 25th, 1972, in the Washington Star. 2 days later, John R. Heller, long retired, is at home with his wife. They're just about to sit down to dinner when the phone rings. The man on the other end of the line apologizes for calling this late, but he's with the New York Times and he has some questions. Heller says he has no problem talking about his time at the PHS as director of the Division of Venereal Diseases. He's 67 years old and has absolutely nothing to be ashamed of. Heller explains to the reporter that he was expecting this call, even looking forward to it. Like the other surviving doctors involved in the formative years of the Tuskegee study, his conscience is clear. In fact, he feels he and his former colleagues have been treated somewhat unfairly. Current government officials should be doing a bit more to stick up for the study's leaders. When the reporter asks about the ethics of denying the test subjects treatment, Heller has to suppress a snort. Test subjects probably got treatment anyway from private doctors they saw on their own time. The reporter asks if there's a record of which test subjects visited private doctors for treatment. Heller shrugs. No documentation on that was kept, but he's sure it happened. Next question. The reporter then asks if there's anything Heller would have done differently if given the chance. The answer to that is no. Heller thinks about Vondelaar, Wenger, Clark. They don't deserve to have their names dragged through the mud. In their defense and his own, he replies, there was nothing in the experiment that was unethical or unscientific. And then he hangs up the phone. Meanwhile, in Tuskegee, Nurse Rivers is in her living room straightening up, duster in hand. She has a lot of time to do that these days, ever since they made her retire in 65 on account of her age. She's not bitter, though, just grateful she got to work for as long as she did. People ask if she's worried about what the papers are saying about the experiment. She replies that she's not worried at all. People can write what they like. They weren't there. They don't know her. She truly cared for those men and helped to make sure they got to their appointments on time, even after she was no longer officially part of the study. Just a few months ago, a neighbor wanted to know why she still did it. Why bother with her patients in the Tuskegee program when she didn't even work there anymore? Rivers replied with the God's honest truth. They're friends of mine. I'm trying to keep up with them so the department can keep up with them. I love those people. She thinks about them now as she looks up at her living room wall. Framed there is her Avita Culp Hobby Award certificate, bestowed upon her by the U.S. Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. She never gets tired of reading the words. To Eunice Rivers, for notable service covering 25 years, during which, through selfless devotion and skillful human relations, she has sustained the interest and cooperation of the subjects of a venereal disease control program in Macon County, Alabama. The certificate hangs between a picture of Dr. King and a plaque inscribed with the Florence Nightingale Pledge. With a smile, she walks forward to dust it off. The phone won't stop ringing Dr. Melvin K. Duvall's office. He's tempted to pull the cord right out of the wall. Duvall is Assistant Secretary for Health and Scientific Affairs for the U.S. Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. His department oversees the CDC, which oversees the PHS, so he barely had a chance to read yesterday's AP story on the Tuskegee study before the damn phone started blowing up. Physicians, politicians, the media, it's endless. In a statement, Senator Proxmire of Wisconsin just declared the study a moral and ethical nightmare. Duvall grimaces. It's a nightmare, all right. There's a knock on the office door and Duvall shouts to come in. It's the secretary, here to write down Duvall's official statement, which will later be delivered to the press. Duvall takes a moment to collect his thoughts, then begins. I am shocked by the Tuskegee study. No, wait. He should be more forceful. He starts again. I am shocked and horrified by the Tuskegee study. Although the study was begun in 1932, and although the opportunity to bring treatment to the men has long since passed, I am today launching a full investigation into the circumstances surrounding it. We will make a special effort to determine why the study was permitted to continue past the time when penicillin became the effective drug of choice against the disease. He asked the secretary to find his spokesman. Duvall wants him to remind the public that when the study began 40 years ago, treatment for syphilis carried fatal risks. That's probably why it was withheld at the time, and he hopes these statements should quiet everyone down while he figures out what to do. Weeks pass as Duvall crafts the official government response to the uproar. Obviously, it's important to do the right thing, but it's equally important to do the right thing in the right way, and there have already been bumps. He announced he'd conduct an internal review, but the public outcry was immediate. Government doctors don't get to police themselves anymore, they said. Well, fine, Duvall can compromise. So today, August 24th, he's on his way to the front of his office building to address the reporters himself. After asking them to quiet down so he can speak, he boldly faces their lights, lenses, and microphones and shares the new plan. He is here today to announce that a citizens' panel will investigate the Tuskegee experiments. It will be run by Broadus Nathaniel Butler, president of Dillard University in New Orleans. Duvall has charged the panel with answering three major questions. 1. Was the study justified? 2. Should the study be continued at this point in time? 3. Are existing policies to protect the rights of patients participating in health research adequate? And if not, what improvements are recommended? Then the reporters begin asking questions, and Duvall dutifully answers each one in turn. Naturally, the first one concerns Butler. What led Duvall to select him to run the panel? For the assistant secretary, that's an easy one. I selected Mr. Butler because he is accomplished, esteemed, and reputable. Naturally, Duvall refrains from saying what's for him Butler's most significant attribute. He's black. Duvall wishes he could point out that Butler is actually one of five blacks on the 9-person panel, and they'll obviously represent the public point of view over the scientific one. He can't think of what more they could possibly want. And also what he doesn't mention, and what luckily no one points out, is that Duvall is still very much maintaining control over one key aspect of the investigation. By restricting the panel to his three questions, he's taking the issue of racism off the table. There is no question 4 asking why the study was limited to black people. In April 1973, the Citizens Panel issues its first report. In his office, Duvall wishes he had a tall bottle of scotch to go with it, because it's just as damning as he'd feared. So much for his argument that the experiment was possibly more permissible by 1932 standards. The panel says it was ethically unjustified even then. It also adds that penicillin should unquestionably have been provided to the men. Finally, the panel asserts that existing protections for human test subjects are ineffective and inadequate. It's time for Congress to create a permanent body charged with regulating all federally sponsored research on human subjects. Duvall sighs. It's truly all out in the open now. He puts down the report, takes off his glasses. And then he's surprised to realize that for the first time, he's curious about what the surviving test subjects make of all this. He has a feeling the government is about to find out.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Why, Charlie, you just have bad blood. They told him that in 1932, when he was just 26. They told him that in 1945, when he was 39. They told him that again just a few months ago, shortly after his 66th birthday. Their faces change over the years, but their lies did not. The government doctors have been laughing at him for 40 years, beating him down in a street fight he didn't even know he was in. Charles Pollard is driving now, his eyes intense, focused on the road, focused on the future, a future that now is entirely in his hands. Better late than never, he supposes. As Pollard accelerates towards his destination, he now has one goal on his mind: payback. Pollard pulls up to the law offices of Gray, C., and Langford in Montgomery, Alabama. He likes Fred Gray. He's a solid lawyer, sharp, but always friendly, always ready to help. A while back, he helped handle some routine paperwork for Pollard. Gray's so humble. To meet him, you'd never know he was the most powerful black lawyer in the state of Alabama. He's exactly what Pollard needs, and he'll know what to do. When Pollard enters Gray's office, the lawyer immediately rises to greet him. He offers a firm handshake, invites him to sit, asks how the family is. But Pollard has no time to waste, no interest in trying to remember all the details the papers printed. Instead, he tells the story plainly. He asks Gray if he's read about the men who were involved in the tests for bad blood. Gray nods. He knows exactly what Pollard is talking about. He's read everything he can about it. Then Pollard tells Gray what he came here to tell him. "I'm one of those men," he says. A smile drops from Gray's face. His eyes narrow as he leans forward. "Tell me everything," he says. So Pollard talks, and Gray listens. Pollard had been at a stockyard in Montgomery. A woman from the newspaper walked up to him out of the blue and asked him if he'd been in the Tuskegee Health Program from the 30s. Pollard confirmed that he had. The woman asked if he knew Eunice Rivers. Of course he knows Nurse Rivers. He watches as Gray takes it all in, taking notes, writing faster and faster and faster. Pollard walks him through it. Year by year, doctor visit by doctor visit, over half his life as a lab rat in their experiment. When the story's done, Gray looks just as mad as Pollard feels. Gray promises on the spot to throw the full weight of his firm at the case on behalf of Pollard and all the other black men, dead and alive, who were tested. Gray tells him that well-deserved money is about to come to him, and a lot of it, that the government has been embarrassed and will happily pay to get this disgrace off the front pages. Gray expects a generous offer in the coming months, and if one is not forthcoming, he'll sue them for everything they've got, and he'll win. Pollard nods. That sounds about right. Payback. In February 1973, Fred Gray sits in Senator Edward M. Kennedy's office on Capitol Hill. It's not the first time in D.C. on official business, not by a long shot. He's only 43, but he's already argued civil rights cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. Before that, he defended Dr. King during the Montgomery bus boycott. And even before that, he defended Mrs. Rosa Parks when she wouldn't give up her seat. Now he fights on behalf of Charlie Pollard. Gray turns as the 40-year-old senator charges in. He seems approachable, matter-of-fact, filled with purpose. And Gray likes him immediately.
Good afternoon, Mr. Gray. I am sorry for the wait. No need to apologize, Senator Kennedy. I appreciate your time.
Kennedy sits down, loosens his tie, takes a moment to collect his thoughts. Then he gets down to it.
What happened in Tuskegee was inexcusable. I understand you're representing the survivors. That's good. Thank you, Senator. I hope to secure for the men what this country owes them. Nothing less, nothing more. Well, I'm here to help. We're both lawyers. We both understand how important it is with cases like this to win not just in the courtroom, but in the court of public opinion. I couldn't agree more. Good. So that said, I want to give you and the men you represent the opportunity to tell their story to the American people. I'm chairing a series of Senate subcommittee hearings on health and human experimentation. We're talking about sterilization, shock therapy, etc. Unfortunately, Tuskegee fits right in.
Gray nods.
It fits in all right. The Tuskegee was a program of controlled genocide. I'll be at the hearings, and I know I can get at least one or two of the men to accompany me. That's terrific. Peter Buxton will be there as well, and together all of us will put pressure on Washington to get the survivors the compensation they're entitled to. Now, let's get to work.
Kennedy rises. Gray does the same. They shake hands. Gray leaves the office confident he's found a new friend and an ally. In late February, he introduces Charles Pollard to Kennedy. The next day, the subcommittee hearings begin. Gray finds the hearings to be surprisingly emotional. Certain days he wants to weep. Other days he's so angry he wants to excuse himself so he can walk it off. But there's no running from this, and there shouldn't be. It's time the crimes of the PHS and the CDC were exposed. They got away with it for far too long. Gray's jaw clenches in frustration as he hears Peter Buxton recall how he valiantly tried to end the study from the inside, but was stonewalled. He nods in agreement when Dr. Jay Katz at Yale says peer review panels don't provide enough protection for human test subjects. He's moved when Pollard and another survivor, Lester Scott, recount how they were systematically taken advantage of, betrayed by men and women they were told to trust, their poverty and lack of education used against them. When Senator Kennedy asks Lester Scott how the government can make amends, Scott says simply, they ought to give us compensation or something like that, where we can see other doctors and continue our health. When it's Gray's turn to speak, he doesn't hold back. He tells those in attendance that these men are done forever dealing with PHS. He says they have no faith, trust, nor confidence that the Public Health Service will properly examine them and give them proper treatment, and that all the PHS will do now is try to cover up their unlawful conduct during the past 40 years. Later, Gray is encouraged to see that Kennedy's rage matches his own. This powerful white senator fully understands the gravity of the crimes committed. Kennedy describes the study as an outrageous and intolerable situation, which this government never should have been involved in. In April 1973, Charles Pollard is out on his farm amongst the crops. He pulls up weeds, tends to the soil. He thinks about the past, the friends he's lost. Why are they gone while he's still here? It doesn't make sense to him. So much of this just doesn't make sense. The phone rings, and with as much speed as he can muster, he walks back to the house. It's still ringing as he steps inside. He picks up the phone and is glad to hear his lawyer, Fred Gray's voice on the other end. Gray thanks him again for testifying at the Senate hearing. He says things will change now. The CDC is going to track down all living survivors of the experiment, even the ones who didn't have syphilis, and tell them they've got free health care for the rest of their lives. Pollard can expect a visit from a field representative soon. And, Gray adds, Pollard should go see a doctor. Any doctor he chooses, someone with no ties to Tuskegee or the government. Finally, he's going to get the care he needs. All of this is good, Gray assures him, but he and Pollard both know it's not enough. This leads to Gray's one piece of bad news. The government has not offered a cash settlement and doesn't plan to. Pollard can only shrug. He didn't have his hopes up. So what's next? He asks Gray. Are we done? No, says Gray. What happens next is this. we sued the federal government for $2 billion. Next on American Scandal, the study may be over, but it's not the end of the story for Fred Gray, survivors, or the African-American community. Just a quick note about our reenactments. We can't always know what exactly was said, but everything in our show is based on historical research. American Scandal is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Sound design by Derek Behrens. This episode is written by Hannibal Diaz, editing by Casey Miner. Executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Jenny Lauer-Beckman, and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a six-part podcast from CBC. Available now.